This is Julie Beal, and I'm going to give you the Kayne Anderson Rudnick 1Q26 market review commentary. I'm going to start talking broadly about the markets and the different components and some of the top line drivers that have changed some of the performance. We'll talk also a little bit about the war in Iran, how it is impacting our companies. We'll talk a little bit about AI and the disruption on software, as well as a little bit of a briefer on what's going on in private credit, and just a quick word on a halo strategy that we've talked about, you may have heard talked about. So let's talk briefly about the markets themselves. Interesting dynamics at play where the S&P moving a little bit lower for the quarter versus small cap actually showing some strength. So a different dynamic than what we had seen up to this point. If we look at the S&P 500 specifically, it looked like a big game of musical chairs where suddenly leadership really started to change and you had a big transition in ownership. I think if we think about the big themes that were at play during the first quarter, obviously the largest of them is going to be the war in Iran. The biggest impact that we've seen directly has been stellar performance in energy companies and also ancillary companies like materials companies that benefit from higher fertilizer costs. So that would be like a CF Industries, which saw a 50% plus return. While we're seeing a lot of excitement about AI, you're seeing a broadening of how to participate in that with more picks and shovels of the data center build out. So you're seeing that in power and heat management. So companies like Generac or semiconductor materials and input companies, all of these stellar performers in the first quarter. The real star, though, was actually memory. So companies that were Albright forgotten, right? SanDisk, Western Digital, Seagate, those are all supply-constrained industries as a result of the AI build-out in terms of memory. And so you saw these companies really performing materially this quarter. It's really important to remember, too, when we're thinking about individual stocks themselves, that you have the overlying narratives, but you also have the idiosyncratic elements that can be impacting them. So if you think about Moderna, that's a great example of it this quarter. Healthcare has been a tough space, right? But even though this company had all these headlines around vaccines and their pivot away from that into oncology, rare disease, they had a legal settlement that took out this patent overhang. They've done a lot of cost cutting. And so they enjoyed a 70%+ return this quarter. Worst performers also had similar key themes. So we've heard endlessly about the SaaSpocalypse, that many high-flying software names are on the brink of widespread disintermediation or outright replacement by cheaper AI solutions. And if you think about information expertise, right, Gartner declining similarly. Credit bureaus, too, have faced a lot of security headline risk. These were classic, high-quality safe havens, but now their pricing power has really been called into question. We've also seen some real fears around private credit. So what started as just a throwaway line from Jamie Dimon about cockroaches has really led to this widespread run for the exits. And so the largest standard bearers that are out there, the Ares, the Blackstone, the KKRs, declining 30% is pretty surprising to see these large moves. It makes sense though, right? Because if I think about the risks in private credit, I'm much more concerned about these very small shops of seven guys, a Bloomberg terminal. But as an investor, I have no way of shorting that. There's no mechanism for me to short that. So I'm just going to find the publicly traded comp that's easy to do that. And I think that's part of what's happened at Ares. I don't necessarily think it's a reflection of their capabilities to underwrite private credit. Oh, but what about the Mag 7, right? If we think about attribution, right? If we think about the index attribution, it doesn't just matter what the stock does. It matters the weight of the stock in the index. And the Magnificent Seven, as we've heard endlessly, are a very, very large weight in the index. And so for them, even if they don't have large declines, it can have an outsized impact on the index. And that was the case this quarter. And I think that's why people have anxiety about index concentration, right? As we become pretty tethered to just a handful of names. So the most under pressure was Microsoft, but Amazon, Nvidia, Meta, Apple, all down high single digits. Tesla declined more than 10%. Google was maybe more resilient. I think I would call this really more of a pause, though, after genuinely a stellar few years. I still think these are very strong companies with very, very large competitive moats. But I think the question is what are the economics of generative AI? And will the true beneficiaries of AI be the owners of the large language models? And will all this investment be worth it? That's still very open for debate. And I think that's genuinely some healthy skepticism. Now, if we move to small cap, you know, it's been years of underperformance. And we saw that start to change in the second half of 2025. And that kind of continued into the first quarter of 2026. Now, that did get pulled back by the war in Iran. And I think that that makes sense. But the Russell still looks like it's on track to outperform the S&P 500. I think it's really interesting if we peel back the onion and look at the different components of the indices, kind of helps us understand what the market is saying the broader outlook looks like, right? The market is a forward-looking machine. If I look at the Russell and the places where there was outperformance, obviously energy was the big outperformer in the Russell, but industrials also did well. And then you see stability in real estate, utilities, and staples, right? People trying to find hard assets. Worst performers were healthcare, consumer discretionary, communication services, and financials. I think what's interesting is if I look at what investors tended to gravitate to in this benchmark, what you saw was that high ROEs underperformed low ROEs. So it's still not what I would call a return to quality as what we would expect. But there were indications that investors are starting to care about fundamental factors, right? So ultra high debt was very punished this quarter. And you didn't necessarily see a lot of trends in terms of what types of valuations were favored. Now, if you did not own any energy, which most of our Kane portfolios don't, you had on the order of 100 to a 200 basis point headwind just from that alone. So that does make it more difficult to outperform when you have something like energy outperforming so dramatically. Some of the dynamics that we talked about in large cap were present too in small cap. So for example, in this technology transition, right, you had all of the AI companies and the fears around software taking those names down. But everything in semiconductors and memory that's very tied to AI, those really did very well. So if I look at the Russell Growth, for example, index, that is a lot more software names. And so technology was a detractor from performance this quarter. If I look at Russell Value, though, most of the tech names there are semiconductor names, and they benefited from this movement towards those types of businesses. But broadly speaking, if I look across the Russell Growth and Value, again, you just didn't see this movement towards higher ROE companies. The real thing that I see, at least, is that debt is the place where people are still willing to punish companies for having. So all is not lost in terms of thinking about quality factors. They're becoming more relevant, particularly as people start to get a little bit more anxious about how the war on Iran will play out. I actually was trying to find time periods that were relevant to what we've seen right now. So I went back to the first quarter of 2022 after Russia had invaded Ukraine, and I saw some similarities. You saw that energy was up 41% in the Russell in the first quarter of 22. Utilities were up 3%, and every other sector was down. Least impacted were industrial, materials, and real estate. Worst performers, consumer discretionary, healthcare, and tech. So actually, in the terms of the sectors that were beneficiaries and detractors, not dissimilar from what we saw in the first quarter. PEs were inversely correlated to performance, which I think is kind of interesting, and higher ROE companies underperformed, though negative ROEs were punished. I think there are some parallels to that period, but I actually think that the most telling time periods, the ones that are most relevant to me, would be that kind of 2010 to 2013 period, as well as the mid-2000s, where quality really underperformed. if I think about these periods, what characterized these periods? These were periods where we were exiting deep recessions, and that early cyclical recovery is going to tend to favor lowest quality names because those were the ones that were most battered by the downturn and sold off the most aggressively. So this low quality rally corrects the oversold conditions, but eventually the fundamentals like earnings growth, return on equity, really start to overtake the stocks that are just cheap. It's not an cheap can be corrected relatively quickly, but earnings quality is what really defines long-term performance. So you're telling me, Julie, why are you talking about a recession? Employment is at very high levels right now, and that's true. But I think as we can all recognize, there is a difference between what's happening on Wall Street and what's happening in the economy. And what we have had is an earnings recession for small cap and mid cap businesses that ended towards the end of last year, 2025. So I think a lot of the early investor enthusiasm for small caps is really centered on the lowest quality parts of the market. And that started to normalize, particularly as earnings put real objective data behind the hopes and dreams of many of our small cap investor peers. I think eventually it really does start to matter. We're already seeing early indications of that when we look at many of the companies that have reported fourth quarter earnings and intra-quarter companies that are on an offset schedule. Investors are really rewarding businesses that are able to still demonstrate good, strong guidance and good returns. So I don't know exactly when it's going to change. That's everyone's favorite question to ask me is when is it going to change? And I would tell you candidly that if I knew, I don't know if I'd be here, maybe. But I do know that over time, the factors that really matter the most to long-term stock performance is earnings quality. And that is the kind of the growth potential and the durability of those earnings. Those two factors are really important. And then returns on equity. And these are the factors that we care about at Cain the most. That really hasn't shown up in our relative performance. But if I look at the portfolio characteristics across strategies, it's been consistent. We haven't had a deterioration in quality in our portfolios. And our process hasn't changed very dramatically. We're incorporating new AI products and ways to think about our business. But the fundamental focus on the relative competitive strengths of the business remains consistent. So I completely can understand that, you know, many clients would love to just get access to small cap, which has outperformed recently by going passive. The problem is you're onboarding a large group of unprofitable companies. You know, last quarter, unprofitable biotech companies, they had a stellar quarter, no question. But it really hasn't made much of a dent on their decade-long destruction of capital. So if you have to take this kind of longer term perspective and recognize that the safest way to get small cap exposure, where earnings growth is expected to be strongest, et cetera, it's by buying quality. Let's talk a little bit about this AI disruption of software. So software has typically been a significant weighting for many Cain portfolios. You know, there's high returns on equity, there's low capital intensity, and in many of the businesses that we favor, there are really high switching costs. So there's durable competitive protections around them. But I think that it's really possible that AI challenges those pillars simultaneously. And so it really has required all of us to look as dispassionately as possible at all of the software businesses that we own and recognize, are there places where they're vulnerable? And, you know, it's hard because these have been probably some of the more successful companies that we've owned. They're easy to own. They make our characteristics look good, but we really have to be able to dispassionately look at them and figure out how are they protected and how are they going to withstand any of the shocks. There's a framework that I think a lot of us are trying to look at as these are the elements that we can look at every business on and see if it's going to be able to withstand the threat of generative AI. You know, the first I would point to is, are there any regulatory barriers around this business? So there are companies that serve the government. They have to be FedRAMP certified. That is a very long process that requires a lot of effort and paperwork to be able to get. Does the software itself help you stay in compliance with your regulatory bodies? So that's a lot of software that's used in really regulated markets like banking and healthcare. new entrants are going to face a lot of structural barriers that are difficult. They're very analog in terms of being able to gain that approval. And so it's not that easy to penetrate that market with a solution, particularly when the stakes are high from a regulatory standpoint. So that could be a barrier that we would look at for a company. The actual transaction embeddedness is what I would term a second. And that's, is this software a system of record for the actual doing of the business, the actual recording of the transactions, the financial transactions? What that really means is, when a CFO or CTO is going to sign off on replacing the system that sits in the middle of the financial transactions, the real raison d'être of the company, right? The reputational and operational risk of switching really raises the bar. And I think that that is a much more durable moat than workflow software, where, you know, this is just part of our workflow. We have found different ways of using generative AI to add a new workflow, and that makes me more efficient as a result. So that's kind of a difference of, is this central to how the company actually makes money? Or is this just a tool that makes your employees more productive? The latter, I think, is much more at risk of disintermediation. And the last I would say is proprietary data. Every software business is going to tell you that they have proprietary data, but there are real differences in how proprietary that data. They may say it's proprietary, but it turns out it's credit card transaction data that can be purchased for, you know, the highest bidder. It may be, they may talk about the proprietary data of the transactions that happened on their platform, and that's great, but that's actually something that can be scraped by a large language model. It's really important to be able to ascertain just how proprietary the data really is. And then the second element that's really important is, where is that data and what is the state of that data? Because there's a very big difference between data that is on 18 different on-premise servers that doesn't talk to each other. It's not harmonized. It's not clean. It's a lot harder to run good generative AI on that data than more modern architectures that are much easier to do that. So it's really important when we're talking about the data itself that companies purport to have as an advantage is, okay, are you really going to be able to leverage that data very effectively in a modern AI kind of way if it's stored in all kinds of different places and all kinds of different forms? It's really, really important to recognize when we're looking at some of these businesses is, what kind of tech debt does this company have? So we try to think of that in terms of, that's kind of what's helping us figure out what types of businesses we think can withstand the generative AI threat. But even if you answer all of those in the affirmative, you have to think about, okay, what if there are still companies that enter these markets? How does that change pricing power? If competition starts to increase, even modestly, you know you're probably going to have some pricing pressure. And if your software business isn't growing at all, it's just dependent on price escalation, even a small compression in pricing is going to have an impact on the P&L. So you have to think too about, what does this do to pricing and can you maintain margins? That's important too if you are thinking about, well, I need to do a lot of investing in my own core technology just to stay at the state of the art. You have to factor that into what you think your earnings projections are. It's really, really important for us, given kind of the whipsaw that we're having in the headline risk, to have a lot of conviction around the moats of the software businesses that we own, right? Because we're going to continue to get these creative writing projects about how software is going to be completely upended by generative AI. We're all going to lose our jobs, what have you. I mean, I should have expected that there would be this many creative writing projects now that we have all these AI tools to help us with our writing. But still, I'm surprised how many of them can have such an outsized impact on the market. Now, if I think beyond software, if I think about sectors like insurance brokerages, I actually feel more positive about those, even though it felt like during this quarter, every day, there was a whole sector that was just getting completely wiped out because people felt there was a real risk that generative AI could displace insurance brokerages or online listings, et cetera. It's really important to be able to recognize at what point is the value proposition of every business. Because if it is pure technology, then I think it is at risk. But if there is something to reputational risk, relationships, risk transfer, it's not necessarily true that better technology is going to be the solution that's going to displace others. I can really understand, though, the emotional selling that hit those names in mid-February, right? It was a very behavioral overreaction rather than a fundamental real reassessment of what are the risks at play. People are very afraid of owning Blockbuster when Netflix is on the rise. That's a natural feeling that a lot of portfolio managers have, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily really grounded in the fundamental drivers of what these businesses really do. So let's talk a little bit about private credit and the exposure to software. So, you know, for us and everything that has to do with credit, look, most of our direct holdings, they're not levered and they're software businesses that tend to have very good cash generation. And so I'm not as worried about that. The question is there contagion through private credit markets? So for sure, we know that private equity sponsors loaded up on software businesses, put a lot of debt on them at their kind of apex peak. They were very, very high multiples and they had great free cash flow. And they really made sense in a private equity context to be acquiring at the time. The problem now is if you own a lot of these software businesses and you have to invest aggressively to modernize the platform, do you have legacy tech stacks? Are you a roll-up, right? We know there are lots of roll-ups in private equity. Just to get your data infrastructure up to speed and able to use AI, does that mean suddenly that the cash flow dynamics of these businesses look really different? And that's not talking about any kind of competition that may take away business from them. So we suddenly have this question of, okay, these sponsors bought all of these companies, assuming that there would be really stable or growing free cash flow. Maybe those assumptions aren't true. And, you know, I think personally that I am much less worried about the large established credit platforms that remember the great financial crisis. I'm much more worried about the smaller, less experienced credit shops. Those are the ones that I have the most concern on the underwriting quality. You know, the thing that gives me some comfort is that there's probably, famous last words, less systemic risk because the banks haven't been able to participate in any really meaningful way. They've done some participation at the margin. So I think it diminishes the systemic risk that this could be a really, really big problem. I do think, though, that you really have to be careful if you're thinking about, wow, these BDC companies have really taken it on the chin. Is that an opportunity? You really want to know what you're buying, because although they will purport to be invested in really only high quality businesses, if they're invested along a single theme and they have concentration around a theme, so they're only investing in data centers, that does give you some risk that you really need to be thoughtful about. I want to close with talking a little bit about, you know, we've gotten lots of questions about people moving towards HALO. So that's high assets, low obsolescence. And I think that those types of businesses, these kind of really analog, often industrial businesses, I can really understand investors wanting to move in that direction, right? Because the waking up one day and finding out that a whole chunk of your portfolio is completely out of favor because people assume it's going to be disintermediated by AI, I completely understand wanting to inoculate a portfolio against that. The thing is that many of these capital intensive businesses have traded at lower multiples because they're capital intensive and their returns on equity are lower. And the thing about a capital intensive business is that you create a lot more leverage in your actual business in a downturn, where suddenly you've had a lot of capital committed to a lot of very heavy assets. And if there is any variability in the demand landscape, you are suddenly very constrained from a cash flow perspective. These businesses typically have a fair amount of operating leverage, and that sounds great when you're gaining operating leverage and, you know, margins are expanding, but the downturns are very, very painful on these businesses. So while I think that the fashion right now towards these halo businesses is great, I think it's important to recognize that it is motivated by the psychology of being afraid that you own Blockbuster rather than doing a lot of fundamental analysis and recognizing that these businesses are competitively advantaged, that the earnings are very durable, and that they are worth some of the higher multiples that they've been experiencing right now. So I think that many of these businesses, be they ones that are connected to the growth that we're seeing in AI data center build out, or ones that are completely divorced from it, but are just being favored right now because they're nice industrial businesses that seem AI proof. I think you have to take a little bit of a more nuanced view and to recognize that as an asset manager, your job is to be able to look through the fashion and, you know, the trends that are happening in the market, and also just the psychology and the fear, and to focus solely on the fundamentals. Even if they are unpopular at the time, our job, we get paid to sweat. And it is our job to be able to recognize what we're trying to do here is to find high quality and fundamental value, even if it's not necessarily the most fashionable thing at this time. I do believe over the long term that quality will really start to matter again, because earnings always matter over the long term. So I think that while this may be a period of underperformance for the firm, I really believe we're well positioned and we're doing the right things to continue to do our best protecting on the downside and participating where we can on the upside. So that's my review. I look forward to all of your comments. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
You've just listened to Canecast. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify. For more of our investing insights, head over to our website, www.cane.com. Canecast is the official podcast series of Kayne Anderson Rudnick Investment Management, CAR. This material is provided as a matter of general information and is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast or research. The opinions expressed herein are those of the speakers and are not necessarily the opinions of CAR or its affiliates, are current as of the date and time of the recording, and are subject to change at any time due to changes in market or economic conditions. The information and opinions contained in this material are derived from proprietary and non-proprietary sources deemed by CAR to be reliable and are not necessarily all-inclusive. CAR does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of this information. This communication should not be construed as an offer or solicitation to purchase or sell any security. Individuals should consult with a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions. Reliance upon information in this material is at the sole discretion of the listener. To the extent any performance is discussed, past performance is not indicative of future results.